great pleasure to introduce our next speaker. He is Keith Loria. I'm sure that any of you who have been attending Western Society for French History meetings for a while know him as an eminent scholar of religion in early modern France with a host of articles. He is the author of Territories of Grace, Cultural Change in 17th Century Diocese of Grenoble, and Sacred Boundaries, Religious Coexistence and Conflict in Early Modern France. And he is so modest and unassuming, he has a one-page CV.
Thank you, Kathleen. In 1683, Jean Forget, a French Catholic missionary to Cochin China, southern Vietnam, reflected on the state of the mission in a report he sent to Paris. It has, he wrote, its beauties and its miseries. Among its beauties, he listed the great disposition the Cochin Chinese had for Catholicism and the great aversion converts had for idols. The Christian and Gentile parties were so clearly distinguished from one another that converts understood, once they had resolved to become Christians, that there was no returning to idolatry. There would be no mixing of religions. And even if converts did fall back into their old ways, which sometimes happened, they retained the true sentiment of their faith, and sooner or later, they returned to it. The miseries Forget listed contradicted its beauties. They were especially noticeable in the converts' understanding of the Catholic sacraments and ritual practices. Converts had a great, as he wrote, ignorance of the maxims of Christian virtue, and their knowledge of the principal articles of the faith was so-so. They could recite the rosary, make their confessions, take communion, and receive holy oil when they were sick, but it was rare that they understood the true meaning of what they did. By means of Catholic rituals, the missionaries sought to construct a religious identity for their converts that would clearly distinguish them, as Forget said, from the other Vietnamese mired in religions the missionaries defined as demonic superstitions. The missionaries had to create a communal identity that would clearly distinguish their converts from, as they put it, the Gentiles or infidels. For Catholic Reformation clerics, the sacraments were a means to this end because they enabled the clergy to exert discipline over their believers. Discipline and boundaries were all the more important in a place where the faith confronted rival religions. The converts' recourse to the sacraments should have secured their membership in the new religious community. Marriage was the one sacrament that did not seem to work the way the missionaries hoped. Marriage posed a real headache for them because, as Forget said, they showed that converts did not really understand the customs of the country, to use his term, that the customs of the country were contrary to the law of God. Vietnamese Catholics should have been following the Council of Trent's marriage regulations rather than certain traditional Vietnamese marriage practices that the missionaries found deeply sinful. But too often, they did not. At the same time that Catholic marriage was to have created a clear distinction between believers and non-believers, it also had to act as a bridge between them or as a means of incorporating non-Catholics into the faith when they wed Catholics. The missionaries did not approve of mixed marriages, but allowed them, if it looked like the Catholic spouse, would bring her or his partner to accept baptism. Too often, marriage did not succeed in doing so. Because the conversions of spouses proved insecure. Furthermore, mixed marriages sometimes led to divorce, something the missionaries opposed, but over which they found they had to make compromises. No wonder marriage provoked missionary migrants. The discipline of the sacrament was hard to maintain because, for the Vietnamese, Catholic marriage regulations were socially disruptive. Of course, that's not particularly surprising. That's the same was true in Europe, as the resistance to Trent's marriage rules by secular governments and parents demonstrated. And some of the issues at stake were the same in Europe and in Vietnam, such as parents' control of children's matches, definitions of consanguinity degrees, marital separations, and celibacy. But in Vietnam, the missionaries also faced a problem they did not encounter at home, namely polygyny. Today, I'm going to focus on the issue of polygyny and divorce, which presented the greatest challenge to the missionaries' conception of marriage. I'm going to leave aside the issue of celibacy and consanguinity, which I must admit gives me headaches as she rose the judge. The missionaries. 17th century Vietnam was in principle a kingdom united under the rule of the Li dynasty, but in reality was divided into two polities, the north, known to Europeans as Tonkin, and the south, known as Cochin China. Jesuits undertook the first sustained Catholic mission in Vietnam, arriving in Cochin China in 1615. They started in Tonkin in 1626, and those who heard John McCormick's paper this morning have already heard about the Jesuit side of this mission. In the 1660s, Rome took leadership of the mission away from the Jesuits and gave it to a new French organization, the Mission Etrangère de Paris, who I'm just going to refer to here as the MEPS. They were secular priests and bishops. It's a lot less tongue-tying. They were secular priests and bishops who could train and ordain a local clergy and set up a parish structure for the Vietnamese church. The upshot was a long-running and extraordinarily nasty turf war between the two missionary organizations, reflected in a sometimes violent conflict between their followers in Vietnam. In commenting on the mission's miseries, Forget forgot to mention that battle. Today, I think, especially given that John has spoken already about the Jesuits today, I'm going to focus on the MEP missionaries. In the 17th century, periods when the Vietnamese rulers tolerated Christian evangelization alternated with periods of fierce persecution. Nonetheless, for the missionaries, the Vietnam mission was an unquestionable success, even if, like Forget, they sometimes worried about how deep their converts' Christianization really went. They claimed hundreds of thousands of baptisms in Tonkin across the 17th century, although the reports vary on just how many hundreds of thousands there were. In Cochin China, the converts were fewer. A report from the 1680s put the number at 60,000. The smaller totals, I think, were likely the result of the fiercer persecution that Christians faced in the southern territory. Still, overall, missionaries baptized considerable numbers of Vietnamese. Marriage issues bore a heavy weight in defining this Catholic community, partly because they have always done so in Christian communities, but also because they set up such an obvious point of differentiation between Catholic and Vietnamese traditions. And nothing did so more than polygyny. In a 1677 report, the MEP missionary in Cochin China, Benin Gache, insisted that the greatest obstacle to Christian conversion in the kingdom was women. A claim that conflicts with the frequent celebration in missionary accounts of women converts as stalwarts of the nascent church. Actually, he was really worried about their husbands, when these husbands were members of royal families or of the Mandarin elite. Such men had many wives, and often would not accept baptism, even when they were well disposed to Christianity, because the missionaries insisted on monogamous marriages. Missionaries pressed potential converts with multiple wives to retain one, the first wife, and to send the others away, and the men were often unwilling to do so. According to Vache, the Tonkin ruler even had declared that Catholicism might be good for the people who can only have one wife, but not for the kings or for the great, for whom that was just simply impossible. Not surprisingly, the missionaries exhibited no great understanding of or sympathy for the social conventions of polygyny. Early modern missionaries, I think, were not always the sharp proto-ethnographic observers we like to think of them as being. For them, husbands with more than one wife were simply bound by their, quote, attachments of the flesh. Although the accounts do admit that the men were troubled at times about how rejected secondary wives would support themselves, and the missionaries had an answer to that. They just argued that repudiating secondary wives would actually be a work of charity, since it was as if the men held these women in captivity. The directive to keep the first wife and repudiate others raised a host of questions. In cases where the primary wife had been baptized before her husband, the solution was clear. He should just simply send the others away. But what if she had not? And moreover, what if she refused baptism? The MEP bishops ruled that in such cases, the husband could keep a secondary wife instead, assuming that she had been baptized. A compromise that, while not maintaining polygynous households, did undercut the notion of only one legitimate primary marriage. And what was one to do if the secondary wives then also requested baptism? The Met Bishop Pierre Lambert de la Motte ruled that they could not receive it, in fact, until they had separated from their husbands. But it was all well and good for a rigorous prelate like Lambert, who was present in Vietnam for actually only short periods, to insist on monogamy. It was another matter for the missionaries on the ground, who found themselves making compromises to which they did not fully admit, guises under which polygynous households continued. The most illustrative example I have actually comes from Jesuit accounts, not from Met accounts. In this particular account, the wife of a newly appointed Cochin Chinese ambassador to Cambodia converted while en route to the new posting, and she convinced 25 secondary wives to accept baptism after she promised to find husbands for them. When her husband arrived, they were traveling separately, when her husband arrived, she pressed him to be baptized as well, but he was not willing to give up his other wives. A solution was found to which the ambassador, his primary wife, the secondary wives, and the missionary could all agree. The secondary wives were now declared to be, quote, ladies in waiting to the primary one, and the ambassador renounced sexual relations with them. Henceforth, they would all sleep, all the women, I should say, would sleep in a chapel so as to protect themselves from any possible backsliding on his part. The agreement, it's a strange story, but the agreement shifted the issue, I think, here from marriage to sexual relations, or rather, actually, to the abstention from sexual relations, and thus could be acceptable to, certainly, to the missionaries. And the Jesuits seemed satisfied that scandal was avoided. Presumably, the MEPs would have denounced this story as just another example of Jesuit laxity, but their solutions to polygyny were not always more rigorous. They frequently encountered important converts with more than one wife. They complained about the Tonkinese Mandarin, for example, the Tonkinese Mandarin, who was generally known in the accounts by his Portuguese baptismal name, Paulo de Abada, an important Christian figure at the Tonkin court. He seems to have been committed to both Christianity and to the Vietnamese customs attendant upon somebody with his position. He had, for example, reportedly built a Buddhist temple in a village where he was the seigneur. To be sure, Abada was a Jesuit ally, and so the MEPs were not well disposed to him, and he returned the feelings. Still, they counted on him at first until they heard that he had a number of wives, and furthermore, that he had pressed the new young Tonkinese ruler to take one of his own daughters as a secondary wife. He, however, was not unique among powerful Christian men. One of the MEPs Tonkinese priests encountered a provincial army commander who was, according to the account, a fervent Christian, and also had a secondary wife, again, a virtuous Christian. And it was difficult for the missionaries to criticize this man, whose military rank made him a valuable protector of the local Catholic population. The MEPs also faced the problem of men who kept secondary rather than primary wives. Jean de Courtelain, MEP missionary in Cochin China, wrote that it was necessary to, quote, cut at the root of this terrible disorder of repudiating legitimate wives, unquote. But in 1676, he was on the point of baptizing a pious Mandarin and 47 of his friends when he found out that the man had sent away his primary wife, who had refused baptism, and kept his last one instead. The missionary admitted that his joy was somewhat diminished, but he allowed the convert to keep his chosen spouse. The first wife had developed both deafness and leprosy, and the missionary reassured himself that she was in fact suffering God's punishment for her recalcitrance and for the lawsuit that she had filed against her ex-husband. Thus, maintaining primary marriages was not necessarily any easier than eliminating polygyny from Christian households. Furthermore, the repudiation of wives could completely backfire because it raised the sensitive subject of divorce. Vietnamese men could divorce their wives, which the Catholic missionaries, of course, found contrary to God's law. They did not see the rejection of secondary wives as divorce. They were, of course, concubines, not true wives. But the insistence on monogamy meant breaking up of marriages, and it could lead to situations with which the missionaries were not at all happy. The Vietnamese sometimes gamed the system the missionaries set up. The first MEP missionary in Tonkin, Francois Didier, complained about just that in 1666. All too often, he wrote, a Christian man took a Gentile wife, a woman, in a first marriage, and if the marriage did not work out, then having only married a Gentile woman, or two, or three, he could repudiate them and marry a Christian or another Gentile woman who was willing to be baptized. Daguet worried over whether he could legitimately just leave the last Christian woman in peace or agree to baptize the last Gentile wife and perform the marriage according to the rules of the church while imposing a penance on the husband for having married earlier wives simply to find out if they were to his liking. In a sense, he faced a conflict here between two sacraments that included converts within the Christian community, baptism and marriage. Women also realized the possibilities Catholic beliefs offered. Among the important local ritual specialists with which the missionaries had to contend were female spirit mediums, who played an important role in religious life by delivering, while in trances, prophetic messages, or serving as intermediaries between the living and deceased relatives. The missionaries described these women, on the other hand, as suffering from what they, of course, knew very well, and that's demonic possession, a phenomenon with which they were well acquainted from the highly publicized cases in early modern Europe. When these mediums were baptized, they became singular examples of the superiority of Catholicism to Vietnamese religions. But this widespread cultural phenomenon, this spirit mediumship or possession, could also intersect with marriage problems. In 1683, the Mep Jean-Baptiste Ossiers de Fongon encountered in Cochin China a Christian woman whose non-Christian husband would not convert. So she faked a possession in hopes of getting him to repudiate her. It was, in other words, a way out of the marriage. The Met missionaries seem to have encountered this strategy on other occasions as well, but usually among non-Christian women who used it either to get out of marriages or to, as they described it, to get their husbands to treat them as divinities. That goal was not, I think, part of the Christian woman's strategy. Her husband did agree to be baptized, and so, as the missionary reports, she no longer had any need for the possession. Admittedly, this case was an extreme example of the problems mixed marriages provoked for missionaries. But as Ossias noted, while mixed marriages were a terrible embarrassment for the missionaries, they were also a necessary evil. When Christian men wed Gentile women, they found themselves forced to engage in a, quote, quantity of diabolical works, in other words, traditional marriage customs, to satisfy their wives' parents. But he admitted, if you prohibit these marriages, then you close the door to the salvation of many good women who by this means come to the religion. And as for Christian women who marry Gentile husbands, they run the risk of abandoning the faith to please their spouses. But if you do not authorize these marriages, then you run the risk of losing the women because the number of women is greater than the number of men. In Tonkin, Didier noted the exact same problem. If difference, he wrote, if difference of religion were an impediment to marriage in this country, then there wouldn't be many marriages. In responding to queries from Didier in Tonkin, Met Bishop Lambert permitted mixed marriages made for, as he put it, good and solid reasons. As he instructed Antoine Enck in Cochin China, if Christians marry Gentiles for good reasons with the intention of bringing them to convert, they committed no wrong. But there was an act. If someone who had embraced the religion could not remain with a husband or wife, in other words, if the non-Christian spouse refused to be baptized or threatened the faith of the Christian one, then the Christian could leave the marriage and make a second one. The idea was actually well established in church marriage law, but brought the situation around again to the problematic use of religion as a means of breaking marriages or of troubled marriages provoking a spouse's desertion of the religion. Ossias recorded a case in 1683, a case that occurred in 1683, he wrote about it later, of a Christian family with five daughters and one son. The oldest daughter married a Christian, but three of her sisters wed Gentiles. The fifth daughter's fate is not recorded in the account. All of the husbands were baptized, so far, so good. The first of these husbands remained a good Christian for about a dozen years, but his addiction to gambling ruined him and he threw his lot in with a criminal gang. The second husband received baptism 4 months after an edict prohibiting the faith, a courageous act. He remained faithful up to 1699 when he divorced his wife according to the custom of the country. And the third husband was baptized 2 years after his marriage, but since he had only done so for his wife's sake and since he had developed some discontent with her, he abandoned both the religion and wife and married a Gentile. The former wife was living with her parents, and abiding by church marriage law, she did not dare remarry. The brother of these women also married a Gentile who had been baptized, and they lived together contentedly for several years, but she developed a great disdain for him. and got him to agree to a divorce according to the custom of the country. She, too, abandoned both her spouse and the faith. What were the poor Christian parents to do? Or, for that matter, what was the missionary to do? The parents insisted their son marry another Gentile woman whom they hoped would embrace the religion. The missionary threatened to deprive them of the sacraments until the husband was dangerously sick, and the parents asked him to come. The invalid offered to return to his first wife and repudiate the second, but needless to say, the first wife was not particularly interested. Once the husband recovered his health, he instead returned to his second wife. The missionary gave in and agreed to administer the sacraments. He said, repaired the scandal, a means of putting the best face on a situation he could not control. Thus, the insistence of Vietnamese Christians on continuing practices against the church's marriage regulations frustrated the missionary's efforts to use the sacrament to impose discipline on the community and rigorously define the religious boundary around it. Or, to look at it from the other side, the threat of social disruption that Catholic marriage regulations presented was diminished. Forgé was wrong about the clear distinction between Christian and Gentile parties. Was he right about the reasons for this blurred boundary? Did the converts just not have a true understanding of their new faith? After all, the problems the MEPs faced that I have described here arose among Christians, not non-Christians. Were the converts just not truly Catholicized? That's the answer to which missionaries often resorted. And historians of early modern missions and of cultural exchange through missions have frequently echoed them. The answer is unsatisfactory for a number of reasons, but here I will offer just two. First, it relies on an assumption that we know what it meant, in fact, to be a true Catholic, a point very much under debate and redefinition in early modern Europe. Second, we cannot read the converts' minds. Rarely in a mission situation do we have any direct evidence of what they thought about their new religion. We have to judge their beliefs from what the missionaries reported. Instead, what we see here in Vietnam is a conflict between the two different purposes to which the new Vietnamese faith, the Vietnamese faith of Catholicism, could be put. For the missionaries, it was to construct clear boundaries. For many of their converts, it was to adapt new religious ideas and practices to their own purposes. Rather than posing the question in terms of degrees of Christianization, we would do better to understand the dual processes at work and how sometimes they reinforced each other, and at other times they clashed. Forgé was asking the wrong questions, but we need not do the same. Thank you.